Russia began holding referendums in four Ukrainian territories it controls. It's a voting measure one expert says is fake and ridiculous, and that Kyiv will never accept.
The expected outcome favoring joining Russia would give it the pretext to claim Ukrainian forces are attacking Russia itself and could dramatically escalate the seven-month conflict.
Plus, the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine releases its initial findings.
Based on the evidence gathered by the commission, it has concluded that war crimes have been committed in Ukraine.
And later in the program, the Ukrainian connection to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Today is Friday, September 23rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Voting began on Friday in four Ukrainian regions mostly held by Russian forces. The start of a plan by President Vladimir Putin to annex a big chunk of Ukraine in what the West says is a violation of international law that significantly escalates the war. From the Associated Press, Charles de Ledesma is up first.
The Kremlin orchestrated the votes, and they're certain to go Russia's way. But Ukraine and the West have denounced them as shams without any legal force. The expected outcome favoring joining Russia would give it the pretext to claim Ukrainian forces are attacking Russia itself and could dramatically escalate the seven-month conflict. The votes are being held in the Luhansk, Kherson, partly Russian-controlled Zaporizhia, and Donetsk regions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Amanda Paul is a senior policy analyst at the European Policy Center. In an interview with the AP, Paul says that, quote, fake and ridiculous referendums, end quote, are a way for Putin to try and make the case that Russia is being attacked by the West.
This is what he's trying to sell to the population. So it's a total reversal of the narrative that he had at the beginning of this war, which was all about, you know, liberating Ukrainians from the evil regime in Kiev, now to saving the motherland, Russia, from evil Ukrainians in the West.
The Russia-recognized Ukraine's post-Soviet borders under the 1994 Budapest Memorandum. Putin considers swaths of eastern and southern Ukraine to be Russian possessions that were lost because of mistakes made by Soviet leaders Vladimir Lenin and Nikita Khrushchev. Paul said the people living in the Ukrainian areas taken over by Russia will be isolated and living in very difficult economic social conditions for the long term. Ukraine says it will never accept Russian control of any of its territory, and it will fight until the last Russian soldier is ejected. A team of experts commissioned by the United Nations top human rights body to look into the rights violations in Ukraine said on Friday its initial investigation turned up evidence of war crimes in the country following Russia's invasion 7 months ago. The experts from the Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine, mandated by the Human Rights Council earlier this year, have so far focused on four regions: Kyiv, Chernihiv, Kharkiv, and Sumy. Eric Mosa, chair of the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine, provided more context.
The commission has visited 27 towns and settlements and has interviewed more than 150 victims and witnesses. We have inspected sites of destruction, graves, places of detention and torture, as well as weapon remnants, and consulted a large number of documents and reports. The Commission met with government authorities, international organizations, civil society, and other relevant stakeholders. Based on the evidence gathered by the Commission, it has concluded that war crimes have been committed in Ukraine.
Presenting their most extensive findings so far, Mosa cited testimonies by former detainees of beatings, electric shocks, and forced nudity in Russian detention facilities. And he expressed grave concerns about executions in the four regions.
A number of attacks we investigated had been carried out without distinguishing between civilians and combatants. This included some attacks with cluster munitions or multi-launch rocket system and airstrikes in populated areas. As regards violations against personal integrity, We were struck by the large number of executions in the areas that we visited. The Commission is currently investigating such deaths in 16 towns and settlements. We have received credible allegations regarding many more cases of executions, which we are documenting further.
He said the team had examined two incidents of ill treatment against Russian soldiers by Ukrainian forces. Musa said an unspecified number of Russian soldiers were found to have committed crimes of sexual or gender-based violence, with victims ranging between the ages of 4 and 82 years of age.
The Commission has documented cases in which children have been raped, tortured, and unlawfully confined. Children have also been killed and injured in indiscriminate attack with explosive weapons. The exposure to repeated explosions, crimes, forced displacement, and separation from family members deeply affected their well-being and mental health.
The Commission plans to gradually expand its investigation with areas of interest including allegations of filtration camps for people being detained or deported, the forced transfer of people, and allegations of expedited adoption of children. Russia's delegation boycotted the council meeting. Reuters' Jason Albano continues our coverage with this story of Russian men heading swiftly to the borders on Thursday following President Vladimir Putin's mobilization order. He reports that traffic at frontier crossings with Finland and Georgia is surging, and prices for airline tickets from Moscow are skyrocketing.
Border traffic intensified overnight Thursday as some Russian men rushed for the exits after President Vladimir Putin's call for partial mobilization, drafting 300,000 reservists. At Russia's border with Georgia, video obtained by Reuters showed traffic Wednesday night. For some, like Ivan, the crossing took up to 12 hours.
I think the Russian border guards are letting people through very slowly. For example, yesterday before midnight, you could cross the border much more quickly. After midnight, either lots of cars arrived at the border or they started to work more slowly.
It was a similar scene on the border with Finland. One man named Nikita said he was afraid to be called up for war.
Yes, I'm afraid.
Asked why by a reporter, he said, because the mobilization is a big mistake for Russia, Europe, and for Ukrainian people. Putin's Wednesday announcement raised fears that some men of fighting age would not be allowed to leave the country. Prices soared above $5,000 for one-way plane tickets to the nearest foreign locations, with most sold out completely for coming days. Alex was one of the arrivals at Istanbul Airport.
I didn't believe that the next step will be mobilization. And I feel that not really many lots of Russian people want to fight and want to be mobilized and want to go to the army.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Russian citizens that the war was now arriving at their doorsteps.
Russia's decision on mobilization is a frank admission that their professional army, which has been prepared for decades to take someone else's land, did not manage to stand it and collapsed. And now, due to mobilization, for most Russian citizens, Russia's war against Ukraine is not something on TV or the internet, but something that has entered every Russian home.
In a call with reporters, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that news of men leaving the country was simply an exaggeration.
The information about the hype at airports and so on is very much exaggerated. It was exaggerated a lot. There is a lot of fake information about this. We need to be very careful about this, so as not to become a victim of false information on this matter.
He also made it clear that Russia was still calling the conflict a special military operation instead of a war.
Jason Albano of Reuters News. Australia has asked for China's help to end the conflict in Ukraine. Officials are considering expelling the Russian ambassador, while opposition lawmakers are calling for more sanctions on Moscow. Phil Mercer takes it from here.
Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong has called on China to use its influence to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Wong spoke to reporters Thursday after a meeting with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Wong said she held a constructive meeting with her Chinese counterpart. Australia wants China to use its position as a permanent UN Security Council member to urge Moscow to stop the war in Ukraine. Australia has promised to continue to provide military support to Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has escalated the conflict, including threatening the use of all weapons and ordering a mass mobilization of reservists, the first time since World War II. Wong condemned Russia's aggression in her remarks Thursday.
These threats are unthinkable and they are irresponsible. His claims of defending Russia's territorial integrity are untrue. No sham referendum will make them true. Russia alone is responsible for this illegal and immoral war, and peace must first lie with Russia withdrawing from Ukrainian territory.
Australia is the largest non-NATO contributor of military aid to Ukraine. It sent missiles and armoured personnel carriers, as well as humanitarian supplies, and imposed sanctions on hundreds of Russian politicians, military commanders, and business people. Canberra has so far spent an estimated $240 million US on armaments and military support to Ukraine. Since February, Australia has granted visas to almost 9,000 Ukrainian refugees. Opposition lawmakers want Australia to follow the United States and increase its assistance to Ukraine. Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Birmingham said the world must continue to apply maximum pressure to Russian President Vladimir Putin. US President Joe Biden and British Prime Minister Liz Truss have agreed to continue their economic and military support to Ukraine. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
For continuous updates on the war throughout the day, be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Thursday evening, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. According to the official readout from the UN Secretary General, the pair, quote, discussed the latest developments related to the war in Ukraine, including in relation to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant and the fact-finding mission on the incident in Olenivka. They also discussed progress in the implementation of the Memorandum of Understanding on facilitating the export of Russian fertilizer and food products and the Black Sea Grain Initiative. End quote. Lavrov defended Moscow's war in Ukraine at the UN Security Council earlier, as the UN warned Moscow against annexing Ukrainian regions, and Western ministers called for accountability over atrocities. The Russian Federation is scheduled to deliver its address on Saturday to the UN General Assembly. As this week's UNGA general debate continues, we step outside the United Nations to take a look at the impact it has on the more than 1.5 million people living nearby. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti takes us to the chaotic streets of Manhattan for a firsthand look.
Imagine being in the middle of this. Bumper-to-bumper gridlock, police cruisers nose-to-nose. No one gets anywhere fast during the United Nations General Assembly. Unless you are in one of the 200 motorcades driving dignitaries to and from the UN. Sergeant Patrick McGuire is with the New York City Police Department in charge of security for the UN General Assembly. He motions to a sturdy concrete barrier that raises and lowers for motorcades.
There's Secret Service, NYPD, and Intel that verify the motorcade that's coming into the area.
Only then do they get in. A ride to the United Nations starts in this operations center. The State Department Bureau of Diplomatic Security takes over the entire floor of a Midtown hotel.
Radio check. Radio check.
We're on clear.
This area gets set up in only 72 hours, but takes 8 months of planning. 1,000 people maneuver more than 100 armored cars, some limos manned with a SWAT team, for dignitaries. J.R. Kulik is coordinator of the agency's security for the UN General Assembly.
What our agents are doing out in the field with these protectees is keeping that secure bubble around the protectee. And it's really interesting because that bubble is a moving one, right? We have to make sure that we maintain those rings of security no matter where they go, any time of the day, any place.
The U.S. Secret Service handles higher government leaders like presidents and prime ministers. The longer the motorcade, the higher level of threat for the leader. Imagine guaranteeing the safety of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The newly renovated 40-floor Turkish mission is directly across the street from the UN, which some officers call a security nightmare.
Now imagine living within the bubble. Those who do always carry their identification and plan ahead.
Kishore Merchandani has lived on 45th Street across from the United Nations for 15 years.
For example, I need to go play golf tomorrow. So I've left my golf clubs with a friend on 65th Street.
Hi, friend.
Toshi Doskar picks up her child from a preschool inside the bubble.
If I'm walking, it's really not a problem. The only issue is if I need to drive.
With all the planning and 12-hour shifts, you'd imagine the New York City police would get a rest after this week. Again, Sergeant McGuire.
We start planning our next event right away. And it's in Manhattan, where there's always something going on.
Imagine that, another traffic jam. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, New York City.
2 years into the repression of Belarusian media, independent broadcaster Belsat TV combats disinformation and propaganda, even as its own journalists are jailed. Tommy Walker has the story.
When thousands of Belarusians protested Alexander Lukashenko's claim of victory in the 2020 presidential elections, Belarus broadcaster Belsat TV was there. But as police started arresting opposition voices, journalists for the independent network found they too had been targeted. Based in Warsaw, Poland, Belsat TV is run by a team of exiled journalists who work with colleagues inside Belarus, but they find it increasingly challenging to operate. Two of its journalists are imprisoned, its staff are denied media accreditation, and in November 2021, Minsk labelled the broadcaster an extremist organisation. Belsat TV Deputy Director Alexei Dishkovitsky says conditions were always tough, but now they rely more and more on citizen journalists.
It's 2022, luckily, so we have internet, we have, as you said, almost everyone has smartphones, so a lot of people who are sending to us some materials. We're cooperating with another organizations who are maybe abroad, but still have their networks in Belarus. And of course, we also have our network.
Safety is front and center for Belsat TV after the arrests of its reporters Katerina Andreeva and Daria Chultsova in November 2020. Belarus sentenced each to 2 years in prison for organizing mass unrest. Then in July, authorities sentenced Andreeva to a further 8 years for treason. The Belarus embassy in Warsaw did not respond to VOA's request for comment. The jailing of their colleagues makes the Belsat TV team even more determined to continue. Alexander Papko from Belfast TV.
I just try to move away this idea that they are in prison, that they are far away, and we may not see them for a long time. So I just keep this warm feeling about them, that they're still free, and it helps to work, to function.
Belsat TV also combats propaganda over Russia's war in Ukraine. One measure, a dedicated program to expose fake news. Smicha Mitskovic is a journalist at Belsat TV.
This is a program that is explaining where this disinformation and propaganda is, and is just uncovering it and just telling what is fake and why, and this is like hardcore fact-checking thing.
Mitskovic, who moved to Warsaw in 2020, says being in Belarus is a risk for anyone who opposes the government, especially journalists.
There are almost no media in Belarus at the moment working. So only a couple of them that are not doing anything about politics at all, about anything what is really happening in, you know, in this public field.
With a government crackdown on press freedom in Belarus continuing, censoring journalists to jail and denying media licenses, independent media like Belset are forced to base their journalistic operations elsewhere. But here in Poland, they continue to inform Belarusians and the wider world of what is really happening on the ground. Tommy Walker for VOA News, Warsaw, Poland.
And finally, one of history's most famous composers, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, has a Ukrainian connection. His son lived in Lviv for 3 decades. So Ukrainian musicians, with a bit of help from the caretakers of Mozart's legacy, put together a very special tribute. Omelian Oshudlyuk rounds us out.
The Costa violin was one of 3 of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's personal violins.
Thousands arrive to see it in Mozart's hometown of Salzburg, Austria, every year.
For the first time in the instrument's 250-year history, a Ukrainian musician recently played the priceless violin. In late July, Andriy Murza from Odessa traveled to Salzburg and played the violin while recording music that will be released in September as part of a video project to raise funds for Ukraine.
This instrument was made by Pietro Antonio della Costa in 1764 and owned by Mozart himself during his Viennese period. You cannot express it in words. You must feel it.
At the Mozart family residence in downtown Salzburg, Antoni Borashevsky, a pianist from Kyiv, is playing the pianoforte, also known as hammerklavier. This instrument dates to the late 18th century. Mozart himself played this keys while composing his masterpieces.
It's a pianoforte, really, not a harpsichord. And it has only one pedal you press with your knee, not your foot, as in modern instruments.
These unique opportunities were made possible by the Mozarteum, a nearly 200-year-old organization that serves to protect Mozart's legacy. The Mozarteum allowed 6 Ukrainian soloists and musicians to play Mozart's instruments in a show of support of its Eastern European colleagues. It's all part of Lviv Mozart, a festival in Ukraine honoring the youngest of Mozart's 6 children, Franz Xaver Wolfgang Mozart, who lived Lviv for 30 years when it was the capital of Galicia, the biggest province in the Austrian Empire.
The works of Mozart the son were performed on the hammerklavier, played by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart the father. It is the premiere here in Salzburg, a sonata by Franz Xaver Mozart that he dedicated to Josephine von Cavalcabo, his muse and Lviv resident, was played on his father's violin for the first time.
Mozart's son founded the St. Cecilia Society and Choir in 1826 and the Institute of Singing in Lviv, the city's first music school. It was Franz Xaver who bequeathed his father's notes, personal belongings, instruments and letters that would become the bulk of the collection of the Salzburg Mozarteum Foundation.
A lot connects Lviv and Salzburg through the Mozart family. The program we presented in Austria is the Lviv Mozartian line. These works were born in Lviv thanks to the youngest son of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Franz Xaver, and his closest circle.
The performers, some of whom have been forced to relocate during the war, are hoping that funds raised by the release of the Solidarity Concert will restore the missile-damaged Kotlarevsky University of Arts in Kharkiv. Omelian Oshudlyuk for VOA News, Salzburg, Austria.
And that's going to do it for us this week. On behalf of the entire team here at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.